This is John Ivey from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the April 12th edition of Sports Illustrated. The content of this material is intended for the print and visually impaired audience. We're going to begin with an article on baseball. On page 52, has a picture here of Wandy Rodriguez, pitcher for the Houston Astros. It looks like he's eyeing his catcher, ready to pitch to the batter. Article is entitled, What's in a Name? For Wandy Rodriguez, everything last season, a decade after faking his identity to get a big league shot, the Dominican native reminded fans of one of the joys of opening week. You never know whose star will rise next. The coach knew the boy had chance. His delivery was smooth and easy. His breaking ball had good late movement to it. And though he was small and skinny, he, like so many other Dominican youngsters, threw hard enough in the mid-80s. The coach had turned the boy into a pitcher and only a few weeks earlier, but the boy was a natural. It was 1998, and a scout from the Astros was holding tryouts in Santo Domingo, 40 miles away from the coach's baseball academy in Bonao. There, the boy could show he deserved a ticket to the majors. But there was a troubling detail. The boy was 19. Scouts don't give 19-year-olds from the Dominican Republic a second look, certainly not one still as raw at that age as the boy was. So, you see, we have a problem. The boy heard the coach tell him, you need to find a new name. You need a new identity. The boy showed up at the tryout and threw a dozen pitches for the scout, a tall man named Ricardo Aponte. He wasn't the best one there, not even close, remembers Aponte, but his arm was loose and free. It wasn't worn down like so many others, and he was left-handed. That's what made him rare. Aponte introduced himself and asked the boy his name and his age. My name is Emmy Cabrera, the boy said. I'm 17. The boy lived with those lies for 4 years. In 2002, 3 years after he signed with Houston, the pitcher that the Astros thought was 21-year-old Emmy Cabrera said that wasn't so. He wasn't Wandy Alberto Rodriguez from the small farming town of Santiago Rodriguez. He told them that he wasn't 21. He was 2 years older. I was scared I was going to be sent home, said Rodriguez. When they said I could stay, I felt free. I didn't have to cheat anymore. The beauty of baseball's opening week isn't just the Pollyannish sense of possibility, the feeling that this could be the Royals or the Pirates or the Orioles or, gasp, the Cubs. Year, it's the thrill of the unknown, the certainty that 6 months from now we'll be marveling at the exploits of someone we barely heard of today. A year ago, Wandy Rodriguez was that player. He'd been kicking around in the Astros rotation for 4 seasons. The owner of a pedestrian 37-40 record and a 4.79 ERA in 102 starts and 9 relief appearances. But by October, Rodriguez, at age 30, had out of nowhere become one of the game's elite pitchers. Rodriguez finished in the top 10 of the National League in ERA, 3.02, strikeouts 193, and quality starts 23, and his curveball was suddenly hailed as one of the best pitchers in baseball. Now, in this 6th big league season, and perhaps on the verge of fame beyond the boundaries of Houston, he's a reminder of one of baseball's truisms. When a season begins, you never know where the next hero will come from. And no, he has no regrets, no guilt over how he escaped Bonao's scraggly fields. Deep down, Wandy knows, without the lie, he wouldn't be here. The boy who didn't want to be a pitcher, he grew up dreaming of playing outfield for his favorite team, the Braves. He had a strong arm and swung a good bat, and in 1994, at age 15, he quit school and left home for Luis Coronado's baseball academy in Bonao. But after the boy had been there for 4 years, Coronado called Wandy's uncle, Faustino Rodriguez, to tell him to take the boy back to Santiago Rodriguez. His uncle said the boy was a big leaguer, says Coronado. I said, how can he be a big leaguer if he can't run or hit for power? Faustino begged Coronado to keep him, and the coach relented. He's smart. He has a good arm, Coronado recalls telling Faustino. I could make him a pitcher. Says Rodriguez, I was mad. I just spent 4 years working on hitting, and now you want me to pitch? It didn't make sense to start all over, but I didn't have a choice. Within months, Rodriguez was throwing 87 miles per hour. But there was the problem of his age. Big league scouts in the Dominican are on the prowl for prospects in their early or mid-teens, not unpolished 19-year-olds. Coronado suggested that the boy would have a better chance of being signed if he were younger, and Wandy and his uncle went about making it appear as if that were the case. They went home to Santiago Rodriguez, where they approached a friend of Wandy's named Ine Cabrera. Wandy and Ine had played ball together growing up. "He didn't play as much as me, but he played," says Rodriguez. "I went to the field one day and I told him what I needed. He just said, 'Okay, no problem.' A few days later, he gave me some papers. Rodriguez returned to Bonilla with a new identity. In January 1999, the Astros handed the boy, now known as Ine Cabrera, a $5,000 signing bonus. He gave $500 to Coronado, $500 to his uncle, took $500 for himself to buy new clothes, and gave the rest to his family to buy cattle. Ine moved slowly through Houston's system. He spent 2 years with the Astros Dominican Summer League team, then moved to the rookie-level Appalachian League in 2001. He showed promise, going 4-3 with a 1.5 ERA and more than three times as many strikeouts as walks that first year in the States, but was still just a middling prospect. Then in the winter before 2002 season, Rodriguez had to face the truth. Before the start of spring training, the real Ine Cabrera told Rodriguez that he had obtained a cedulla, an official identification card of the Dominican Republic. Rodriguez would therefore be unable to pass himself off as Cabrera when he applied for a United States work visa before spring training. After 4 years of lying, the ruse was up. Rodriguez was so ashamed, so frightened of the consequences, that he sent his uncle and aunt to tell Aponte who he really was. "Wandy was hiding in a car in the parking lot," says Aponte. "I walked over there and said, 'It's going to be okay. Just work hard and win back the confidence of the organization. We're not going to send you home.' He was a different person after that. His confidence grew. He was happy. Finally, Wandy Rodriguez could exist." As a prospect, Wandy Rodriguez was no name. Going into the 2005 season, he was a 26-year-old who had never pitched before AA, pitched above AA, so far under the radar that he wasn't among the 900 prospects listed in Baseball America's annual prospectus of minor leaguers. Minor league expert John Sickles didn't include Rodriguez in his guide of more than 900 prospects that year either, and Sickles had even seen him pitch in person a year earlier. "His fastball was mediocre," says Sickles, who runs the website minorleaguebaseball.com. "His command just wasn't there. His strikeout rate was going down. His performance at AA wasn't great. He was giving up more than a hit per inning. But there was something there. Rodriguez could throw a nasty curveball. The first time I saw him in 2001, he wasn't throwing it for strikes," says former Astros general manager Tim Perpua. "But even then, you saw he got a tremendous downward plane on it. You thought, with that pitch, this kid's got a chance." The Astros gave him a shot in May 2005, calling him to the majors after just 8 starts at AAA Round Rock. Rodriguez won 10 games as a rookie, and by 2007, that curve had helped him earn a full-time spot in Houston's rotation. For 2 years, his performance was nondescript, but last year, Rodriguez was able to dominate because he was hitting with his strike one fastball down and away, says Dewey Robinson, the Astros pitching coach in 2008 and 2009. "Hitters have so much trouble squaring up on the curve. He could do anything after that. After that first strike, throw the curve for a strike, bounce one in." According to the website FanGraphs, Rodriguez wasn't simply the most effective curveball in the baseball last year. It was one of the top 10 pitchers in the same class as Justin Verlander's four-seam fastball, Chris Carpenter's two-seamer, and Tim Lincecum's changeup. Last year, Rodriguez threw curves a major league high 36.8% of the time and generated outs on 23.9% of them. Only 6 other pitchers had a pitch that delivered a higher percentage of outs. Rodriguez even saw his velocity increase, sometimes touching the mid-90s. "Wandy gets a lot of his power from his legs," says Robinson. "A big thing for him is that over the last few years, he's really built up his strength in his lower half. He throws harder at 31 than he did at 21, says Sickles. He's a model example of how someone with a very unimpressive minor league track record can still develop into a very interesting pitcher. His development curve has been unlikely, to say the least. Rodriguez is also one of the few pitchers to handle Albert Pujols, who has just 5 hits and no RBIs in 31 at-bats against him. "People are finally noticing what I've been saying," says Astros right-hander Roy Oswalt. "Wandy has the best curveball in baseball." The Astros are counting on another big season from Rodriguez, especially with Oswalt, Houston's 32-year-old longtime ace, fighting a nagging hamstring injury in spring training and coming off the worst season of his career. Rodriguez is only 17 months younger than Oswalt, and yet their careers seem headed in different directions. "What we saw from Wandy last year wasn't a blip, but the beginning of something," says GM Ed Wade. "He's going to be a frontline pitcher here for years to come." Life has settled down for Rodriguez, who will make $5 million this year after losing his arbitration request for $7 million. Last week, his wife Luz gave birth to their second child, Amanda. The boy from Santiago, Rodriguez, though, remains close to his past. This offseason, Rodriguez went to Borneo to visit and work with a coach who gave him a chance. And he still talks to Cabrera, who is now a student in the Dominican. "I wish things could have been different, that I could just be myself for those years and still be in the major league," says Rodriguez. "I didn't want to lie, but I think I had to." He adds, "and everything has worked out okay." The right stuff. Wandy Rodriguez made the leap to elite starter last year. Who will be the breakout pitcher of 2010? Keep an eye on this quartet. Brett Anderson from the Oakland A's. A rookie last year, the left-hander had a 3.48 ERA and 86 strikeouts in 88 innings after the All-Star break. Just 22, Anderson, who recently added a changeup to a repertoire that includes a 95-mile-an-hour fastball and a killer slider, could put up those kinds of numbers over a full season. John Banks from the White Sox. The 25-year-old left-hander led Chicago's rotation in quality starts 20 and ERA 3.77 last year. Banks was 31-33 over his first 3 seasons, but if he can improve his command, he walked a team-high 73 batters, he could hold his own on a staff that includes Jake Peavy and Mark Bury. Jonathan Sanchez from the San Francisco Giants. In his first 2 seasons as a starter, the lefty, 27, had excellent strikeout rates, 8.94 Ks per 9 innings pitched in 2008 and 9.75 in 2009, but struggled with command. Sanchez's 11 strikeout no-hitter last July was no fluke. In 2009, only 3 pitchers generated a greater percentage of swings and misses, 27.6% of his pitches. And finally, Max Scherzer of the Detroit Tigers. Because of his violent delivery, injuries have always been a concern for the righty, who was traded from Arizona to Detroit in December. But Scherzer, 25, was impressive in 2009, his first full season, 9.19 strikeouts per 9 innings pitched. Moving to the American League is an issue for many pitchers, but not one with Scherzer's 97-mile-per-hour fastball and nasty slider. Well, let's go right into pro basketball. This article features Steve Nash, point guard for the Phoenix Suns, and has a picture of Steve on page 57, holding a basketball under his arm and just kind of relaxed in a pair of jeans. The title of the article, "The Genuine Point Guard." Staying true to his Canadian roots, his left-leaning views, and his playmaking principles, Steve Nash of the Suns shows no signs of slowing at age 36. A cold spring rain passes through the Broken Mountains. The morning is gray and laced with it, and it lashes the cactus plants and the arid bush and the birds that call with voices as rough and jagged as the topography. The rain changes the aspect of the desert, softens it into something unlike itself, something liquid and less implacable, something habitable and conventional and less wild, a place where things have to work less hard to grow. El Coro, Lodge is opening in late morning. Silent men in coveralls sponge the water off the tables on the patio. It is a place like so many that have been carved out of the desert in the hillsides outside Phoenix. People come here to do business over lunch or to celebrate bibulous anniversaries and promotions and the other minor benchmarks by which success has been measured in the centuries since the desert became another place for the commerce of cliché, that is, modern American life. The morning comes alive. The chatter at the bar gets louder, almost drowning out the music on the sound system. A Canadian named Neil Young is singing about burning out and fading away. A busboy sings along. Nobody at the bar knows the words. There's no golf course in sight, but everybody there looks as though they've just birdied 18. Outside, a guy on a silver mountain bike glides up to the valet parking stand. There's a long-sleeved T-shirt under the short-sleeved tee and a pair of gray shorts, and the hair is in some place halfway between the pillow and the morning breeze. The face seems to spread itself open at the bones. The blue eyes wide and the cheeks broad and chiseled. The whole aspect is something both controlled and askew, off-plumb, but unbalanced. Steve Nash hands his bike to the valets. They park his bike in a lot between a couple of Cadillacs, which look no more like Cadillacs used to look than this place looks like the primordial desert. On a chilly rain-washed morning, in a place that's supposed to be neither chilly nor rain-washed, amid the banalities and air kisses and petty contrivances of a dozen business lunches all around him, Nash seems to be the only soul in the place who's real. "I've always had a feeling in my life that great things are to come," he says. "My life is definitely a bubble, but it's all about how freely and easily you depart from it. And I love my departure from the bubble. I love thinking. What else am I going to do?" It has been a good season with the NBA's bubble for Nash and his sons. Last season was a lost one. After Mike D'Antoni departed to coach the Knicks, Phoenix struggled to find an identity under Terry Porter. In no small part because of the presence of Shaquille O'Neal, Porter slowed down the Suns, and the effect was not unlike slamming a high-powered engine into a low gear. Springs flew. Pistons cracked as the point guard Nash felt the shuddering most acutely, both in his game and in the team's. Nash's drop in production prompted speculation that at 35, he'd taken one step down the other side of the hill. However, under Alvin Gentry, who replaced the fired Porter last February, the Suns reignited themselves. They won Gentry's first game by 40 points and scored more than 140 in each of his first three, and finished the season with a 12-5 run that wasn't quite good enough to get them into the playoffs. The momentum carried over to this season. With O'Neal gone, off to loom over Cleveland, Phoenix started the season strongly, winning 14 of its first 17. After a brief midseason hiccup, during which time the team was openly shopping power forward Amari Stoudemire's huge contract, the Suns won 9 straight in March, and at week's end were tied for second in the Western Conference. Nash once again found himself with every aging point guard's dream, young, hungry big men to whom he could fire passes off his hip, especially Stoudemire, who, with his contract situation settled for the nonce, became ferocious once again. "I'm happy because this year we are where we should be," Nash says. "I don't think we should have been an 8th, 9th, or 10th seeded team going into last year. I think struggling is inevitable when you have a different coach and you have to account for some major personal moves, even if it's one or two players. Shaq, I think, was a player that demanded us to at least attempt to play a certain way. That's one reason why there was a big change last year. And now, this year, without Shaq, we're back into something very similar to the way it used to be. I expected this. I mean, take out the time with Terry Porter. I was just the same player. The last 2.5 months with Alvin, I played just the same way I always have. I think people were misled by the first 3.5 months, thinking I was going downhill, slowing down. It was misleading, but I was never misled. I knew what I could do. I came back this year, and the ball was back in my hands again." By any measure, Nash is enjoying a signifying season. Through Sunday, he was averaging 16.6 points a game and 11.0 assists, shooting 50.5% from the field and 42.3% from beyond the three-point line. Once again, there's a freedom in the way he's playing. With his hair flying and his eyes wide, he is a compelling figure in the middle of a fast break. And when he angles a path to a spot where his teammate will be instead of the spot where the teammate is, you can see a supple, malleable mind at work, one that perceives a uniquely personal order in the chaos, what an artist might call a vision of how things are supposed to work. I think a big reason for Steve's success is his mind, explained Phoenix general manager Steve Carr. It's about seeing those angles that most players don't, about thinking the game in concepts. That's all creativity in the mind. It's the same with myself, says Stoudemire. When you have creative minds, you get involved in different sports, in different cultures, and it allows you to open up on the basketball court and just be yourself. Steve's a heck of a soccer player. He's one of those skateboard guys. For the most part, you want to be yourself. Being yourself allows you to play better, to have more fun. It opens up your spirit. The NBA has opened itself to the world over the 12 years since Nash came into the league. He was a bit of an anomaly then, a South African-born Canadian who won over people as a basketball playmaker at Santa Clara, but whose heart had a place for soccer that basketball would never touch. Now, foreign players are salted throughout the draft every year, and they've festooned the All-Star Game rosters. It was fairly common when I was a rookie, but now it's tenfold, says Nash. It's improved the culture for the NBA, and it's improved the game. It's important not to be homogeneous. It's important to grow and to expand. The Renaissance man is having an altogether Renaissance year. And there's a picture here on page 58 with Steve Nash in the middle of Amari Stoudemire and former Phoenix Sun center Shaquille O'Neal. And also a big picture of Steve Nash smiling on page 59. The article continues on page 60. Olympic torch in the native British Columbia, jetting back and forth on the sly from All-Star Weekend in Dallas to do it, and he's launched his own film production company back home as well. It is of a piece with his whole life. Nash has always been beyond the court. His politics are left of center, at least for an athlete playing in an American sport. For a Canadian, they're pretty much mainstream. I still don't understand the new healthcare system here, jokes Nash, who grew up under the single-payer system to which Canadians are so devoted that they named its creator, Tommy Douglas, the greatest Canadian of all time. He's also Kiefer Sutherland's grandfather. Back in 2003, when hardly anyone else in his profession did, and when nobody else in Dallas did, Nash, then playing for the Mavericks, spoke out against the rush to war. This did not make him popular. I got called a commie, he chuckles now. It wasn't that I so much didn't like the 3 weeks afterward. It was the stupidity of the Inquisition. I was careful in what I said to a point and to a purpose. I would hardly venture to say I thoroughly read political history at all. Obviously, I'm left-leaning for certain, and I'm all for the capitalism. But at the same time, I feel that education and health care are human rights. He has been a witness, then, with the shrewd eye of an outsider to the NBA's transformation into an engine of what Joseph Nye calls soft power, the great galumphing presence of American popular culture in the rest of the world. Popular entertainment, writes Nye in Soft Power, the means to success in world politics, his seminal 2004 work, often contains subliminal images and messages about individualism, consumer choice, and other values that have important political effects. Nye specifically mentions that even popular sports can play a role in communicating values. But Nash also has a sense of Soft Power's inherent trap. So many of its globalized manifestations are driven by corporate imperatives that it homogenizes everything it influences. The authentic is no longer anatomic to the artificial, not with Camden Yards and throwback jerseys stitched by children in China. When authentic is just another brand, the only antidote remaining to the artificial is the genuine, which must always be defined as a million different individual personal choices. You lose track of what's going on outside, says Nash, as the lunchtime business gabble reaches a kind of climax around him. When I said bubble, I meant more than an introspective level. Sometimes you need a moment to realize that you are a person, not a robot. You need a moment to remind yourself to live your life. Celebrity, Nash insists, is boring. On the one hand, you can't say it doesn't give you things. On the other hand, it's a pain in the as and is to be wary of, which is not to say that celebrity can ever be an efficient tool like a crowbar. For example, this year, Nash and his cousin, filmmaker Ezra Holland, launched Meat Hawk Productions in Victoria, B.C. over the past several years. Nash has developed a serious joint for this sort of thing, directing and producing several popular YouTube films, including a spoof of the movie Step Brothers, starring himself and Baron Davis, in which Nash and Davis ride a tandem bicycle, and Nash, bedecked in red suspenders, a bilious Hawaiian shirt, and plaid shorts, attempts some of the knee-knocking dance that appears to be an ungodly hybrid midway on the Caucasoid scale between the Charleston and the Kazatsky. He's also responsible for some hilarious videos filmed on the Sun's charter flights, the butt of which seems always to be Robin Lopez, the young center with the frazzled hair and look of perpetual astonishment. At least one of these videos is not safe for our younger viewers. Working with Holland, Nash developed the idea of doing a documentary on Terry Fox, the cancer patient and amputee whose attempt to run across Canada galvanized the country in the summer of 1980. At about the same time, ESPN contacted Nash to ask that he appear at the ESPYs, the network's annual attempt to demonstrate that the primary difference between athletes and actors is that Stuart Scott is not Barbara Walters. Nash had been asked to appear before. He had been nominated. He had never attended. He always had better things to do in the summer. Walking a red carpet? That's not really my cup of tea, he says. I got my soccer games and my kids and my friends in New York City. You walk outside in New York and the whole world's there. Nash, his Paraguayan-born wife, Alejandra, and their twin 5-year-old daughters spend every summer in the city where Steve and Alejandra met. Nevertheless, Nash saw the opportunity to leverage his celebrity. He agreed to come to the ESPYs if he would be allowed to pitch his Fox documentary to the producers of ESPN's well-regarded 30 for 30 series. It will air on the network this fall. I loved movies as a kid, he says, but my parents weren't into it, and I was playing tons of sports. In college, I started to go more often, with my eyes and ears open. My wife had a big influence on me because her father was extremely passionate about it. I learned a lot more when I was dating. He's already planning his next project, a documentary about Pelé that may take him back to South Africa this summer for the World Cup. His face lights up when he talks about soccer. You know, he says, the dream never dies. It would be a kind of homecoming for him. He was born in Johannesburg in 1974 to John and Jean Nash. They met in a London nightclub. John was a printer and Jean worked as the executive assistant in a stock brokerage. John was also a gifted soccer player, and when the opportunity came to move to South Africa, where he could work his trade, play his game, and get paid for doing both, they jumped at the chance. You can see Steve in each of them. He had his mother's quick smile, but the broad planes of his face are his father's, and so the slightly sidewise look at the world. Upon explaining that he finished his apprenticeship in London, John is quick to mention that because of that, I can wear a sword in the city of London, and I'm allowed to drive sheep over London Bridge. The original London Bridge has, of course, been relocated to Lake Havasu City, Arizona. So I was a compositor. I used to set type, John continues. By the time I finished my apprenticeship, I was obsolete. After 450 years, they decided it was obsolete. Goodbye, Gutenberg. Once Steve was born, neither Jane nor John wanted to stay in South Africa. They sensed the deadly paradox of apartheid, what appeared to be immutable, mask of terrifying fragility, the iron authoritarianism of the system. Passed laws rigidly and ruthlessly enforced white supremacy was unsustainable. Well, that's about all we have time for. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm John Ivey, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is available on podcast after the broadcast. So long, until next time.